This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
The Center for Popular Democracy and United New York organized Workers Rising, a conference to celebrate and discuss the exciting new formations and activism of low-wage workers in 2012 to drive that momentum towards more victories in 2013. In 2012, a wave of worker organizing rose across low-wage industries in New York City and across the nation, propelled by workers' anger at poverty wages and intolerable working conditions. Supported by community, faith-based groups, unions, and elected officials, these workers participated in nationwide protests at Walmart, led the first coordinated strikes in the history of America's fast food industry, unionized at car washes and groceries, and took on major New York City retailers' efforts to offer only part-time work. We begin with Deborah Axt, co-executive director of Make the Road New York.
President Obama and the State of the Union address highlighted the push for comprehensive immigration reform and committed to delivering it. He decided to push for a raise in the minimum wage and indexing. These things are not happening out of the goodness of his heart. These happened because immigrants and workers and working families are organizing, building a base of power, and demanding that our government officials respond. We're building real organization, permanent organization on the ground in workplaces and in communities that can demand government response, that can demand that capital respond, and that can win real improvements in working people's lives. And the organizing that's going on is driven by workers. It's anchored in community groups like Make the Road and like New York Communities for Change. It's anchored in organizing models that are new or revived from prior decades. And the organizing is backed and supported by and nurtured by visionary union leaders who see that it's time to follow working people's lead. Innovative union leaders like Stuart Applebaum of the Retail Wholesale Department Store Union backing our car wash organizing, like Hector Figueroa of 32BJ here and SEIU nationally. And 2013 is really the moment to say, movement building is happening on the ground, and it's time for us to demand that our government also follow working people's leads. And the role of everyone here in this room is contagion. We have to help it be more contagious. The car wash worker organizing here, inspired largely by what was happening in California, and is now in turn inspiring what's happening in Chicago, what continues to happen in other cities, right? Fast food workers are rising up. It is inspiring what's happening in other places across the country. So we're going to turn now to talking about the national impact, right? How we can make that contagion real and what is the landscape at the moment. And I'm going to ask the incomparable Stephen Greenhouse to facilitate the rest of this panel. As everyone knows, of course, Steve Greenhouse is the leading labor reporter in the country, with the New York Times for many, many years, and has also done extensive and beautiful publishing on the worker organizing that we're all part of.
It really is an unusual time for activism among low-wage workers. I, as a reporter, have often wondered, kept wondering why there hasn't been more activity, more activism among lower-wage workers. And lo and behold, last year we really saw the beginning of activism among low-wage workers in a very serious, visible way. Our Walmart campaign, the car wash efforts in New York and Chicago and L.A. And it's interesting to see unions like the retail wholesale workers here, the steel workers in L.A., working with immigrant worker centers to organize the car washes. And then last November, I got a phone call saying we're organizing this fast food strike at dozens of restaurants in New York. And I told my editors, this will be the very first strike in the fast food industry in the history of the United States. So I wrote a story about this fast food effort and rising up. So I'm going to introduce the panel, Patricia Smith. She was New York State Labor Commissioner for many years. She did a lot of aggressive enforcement. And now she is the solicitor of the U.S. Labor Department. She's been very active on a range of issues, including trying to improve safety in coal mines. When she was a labor commissioner here in New York, she did a whole lot of work on enforcement against wage theft. Then Angela Falcone is the founder of the National Institute for Latino Policy. Been very active on low-wage issues, worker centers, trying to raise living standards, working standards for Hispanic workers. Dorian Warren, he's a professor at Columbia University, but he seems to be juggling a thousand things, always giving speeches, always working to push labor activities forward. So I wanted to begin by posing questions to both Dorian and Tricia Smith. You know, the economy has been changing rapidly. We're seeing greater use of computers, greater outsourcing. Many companies seem to be pushing out workers who make $16, $18 an hour and trying to replace them with workers who make $7, $8, $9, $10 an hour. We're seeing a decline in pension benefits. A lot of companies are increasingly trying to use temporary workers, independent contractors. When I wrote about fast food workers and our Walmart workers, a lot of these efforts by low-wage workers has been getting a lot of press attention. But for me, the big question is, how does this translate into real gains in wages, working conditions, benefits, living standards for these workers?
One of the biggest threats to all workers these days is the fact that in this economy, there are no longer clear lines of employer liability, employer relationships. When you walk into a McDonald's or any fast food place, you don't know who the people behind the counter who are serving you are working for. They might be working for the McDonald's Corporation. They might be working for a franchisee of McDonald's. They might be working for a temporary agency that supplies either the McDonald's Corporation or the franchisee. When you blur those lines of employer liability, we're seeing more labor law violations. One of the real challenges for enforcement agencies, unions, for low-wage worker groups, is to hold people responsible, find ways to push back against what I always call going up the food chain, right? And hold the person, that individual, that corporation at the top responsible, and try to stop this trend of outsourcing and temp agencies, all of which is an attempt to get around liability.
We've shifted from a General Motors economy to a Walmart economy. The General Motors economy of the 20th century meant that workers had ladders of opportunity, got hired by a manufacturer usually, living wages, high wages because they were unionized or there was a threat of unionization, pension benefits, healthcare benefits were included into that employment contract, full-time work, vacation. That economy is over. We're now in the Walmart economy, part-time work. More and more employers are preventing employees from getting access to healthcare benefits. We're one of only two rich democracies in the world that has a strange system where we get healthcare and pension benefits from our jobs. Everybody else gets it through the government. We're one of only two rich democracies. We decided we were going to provide those benefits through employment. And employers are now saying, we're not going to do that anymore either. So that's part of the problem of insecurity workers are facing. If you don't have access to healthcare, you don't have access to pension benefits. Patricia mentioned this problem of outsourcing and subcontracting. And one of the numbers I've heard recently is that of all major global corporations, 60% of their workers are subcontracted. They don't work directly for that employer. They're shifting liability onto these temp agencies so they don't have to worry about being sued for not paying a minimum wage or overtime. They don't have to worry about offering healthcare benefits. In 2009, 24% of our economy were low-wage jobs. By 2020, 40% of our economy will be low-wage jobs unless we do something about it. Frankly, a $9 minimum wage is not nearly enough to do anything about low-wage work. We have 40 million low-wage workers today. By 2020, that number will double. Part-time jobs, low-wage jobs, no benefits, no social contract, no ability to move up in a job the way 20th century workers were able to. Finally, I haven't mentioned technology at all, the rise of a digital economy. As you know, unemployment is about 8%. It's double for African Americans. With increasing technological advances, you can add 3 to 5 percentage points of unemployment in terms of how, whether robots or some other kinds of technological advances will replace the need for people in many, many jobs. We're looking at an economy of not only low-wage work in the future, but also of high and permanent levels of unemployment.
We're beyond the Walmart economy. In a Walmart economy, we have low-wage work and part-time work, but at least we have an employer and employee. We're seeing an increasing number of situations. Employers are calling who are really their employees, independent contractors. That's one of the leading causes of wage inequality. One of the things that you see is when, and I've seen these websites, right, we'll turn your employees into independent contractors. What happens? Employers get a 30% reduction overall in costs because they're not on the hook for workers' comp, they're not on the hook for unemployment insurance, they're not on the hook for their half of the FUTA taxes. So you get a 30% reduction in workers' salary right then. You used to see it in construction, okay? There are legitimate contractors, there are not. But now we're increasingly seeing it in the retail economy, the restaurant industry, the hotel-motel industry. We've always seen it in places like landscaping. And just recently we settled a case against an internet company that had at-home workers who they were calling independent contractors. So I think we're way beyond Walmart.
A large percentage of the nation's low-wage workers are immigrants. Any effort to try to improve conditions for low-wage for the tens of millions of low-wage workers also needs a strategy to bring in work with immigrant workers. And when I wrote a very depressing story a few weeks ago about the percentage of the percentage of union members in the United States dropping very sharply last year, among the few bright notes was that while the number of whites in unions dropped by something like 540,000, the number of Hispanics in unions rose by more than 100,000, and the number of Asian Americans in unions rose by 60,000. So I wanted to ask Angelo what you think the changes in demographics mean the low-wage economy and for efforts to raise wages and standards for low-wage workers.
One of the things that is kind of neat about the change in demographics, at the same time that it's creating tremendous challenges in terms of how we organize, is also driving people in power a little nuts too. It's nice to see the Republican Party trying to figure out what the hell to do, and to see Marco Rubio trying to figure out, didn't he have to move to the left to get that to the water? You know, that's always kind of interesting. But one of the things that I always found amazing, we talk about organizing in immigrant communities, was over 10 years ago, I remember beginning to see people, the greengrocers, workers, organizing. And I used to walk around and see these Mexican guys picketing, and I'm saying, you know, these guys are here like, they're like not here legally. These guys got a lot of balls organizing like this, because they could get deported and all sorts of stuff. It was kind of interesting, the kind of movements that we saw in a place like New York City to kind of make it safer for immigrants to feel comfortable enough to be able to do that. It was very promising in terms of beginning to lay out like a framework by which folks that normally you would think would be so terrified to assert their rights actually feel that they could assert their rights. To me, that's encouraging, because it's messy, you know, the situation, but within that mess is, I think, where you could really see some progressive change occurring. That's important. The other thing is, talk about immigration reform. I think the other interesting part of this is that a lot of this low-wage stuff that we talk about, a lot of it is somehow connected to the people that are here, undocumented workers that are being exploited. But they're also, of course, it goes beyond immigrants. When we talk about low-wage workers in a place like New York City, we talk about a large number of folks that are immigrants, but also when we talk about African Americans and you talk about Puerto Ricans, groups that have very high poverty rates, much higher than anybody else, and also have very large numbers of people who are low-wage workers. So that the struggle is a question of looking at the issue of immigration rights, immigrant rights, and also expanding it. So that at the same time that we talk about worker solidarity and we talk about class dimension of this, I think we need to make sure that we understand the racial ethnic dimensions as well. That we don't start talking about some amorphous concepts like the middle class. It drives me crazy. I don't know how that means. Middle class. We start basically moving away from understanding that there are these very specific communities that have their own histories, their own structures, that the kind of structures we need to understand if we're going to be doing effective organizing. That's a major challenge, and I think we need to be very conscious of those changes and those challenges. At the same time, connecting these various issues, as already been pointed out, that these questions, these labor questions, need to be connected to political issues. One of the struggles in the Latino community has been the question of trying to get better representation in terms of public sector employment. Decades ago, People used to tell me, well, what the hell are you pushing for a lot more Latinos to get junky government jobs? They say, well, these junky government jobs, they have pensions. They're not that bad. And today, we actually see that these junky government jobs, as much as they're under, you know, siege, hey, they ain't bad compared to the private sector jobs. So that's, I think, an arena of struggle as well around in terms of public sector employment, which leads to the issue of the role of government, right, which was a big discussion around the State of the Union, and that we need to assert the importance and the important role of government in terms of fighting for the rights of our communities and for low-wage workers. It's not going to happen by itself. Government is key in terms of developing political strategies that are really going to make a difference in terms of these issues.
So a lot of our conversation a year ago was about a movement that many of us have nearly forgotten, the Occupy Wall Street movement. And my sense is that movement had one huge accomplishment. It really created a national conversation about inequality and the 1%. The momentum of the Occupy Wall Street movement has really died down. Now we're seeing the rise of the low-wage workers movement. But I wanted to ask Deborah, Dorian, how do you think the concerns about inequality, the energy of the Occupy Wall Street movement could be harnessed for the low-wage workers movement?
One of the big lessons is that we can't be so controlling. We've got to take risks. For Occupy Wall Street, there were a bunch of us in this room and throughout the city that put together a very disciplined effort to mobilize 20-plus thousand people on May 12th around exactly the same messaging. And we had some huge fights about whether it was a good idea to occupy City Hall Park or whether or not, whether that was too confrontational, whether we were alienating all of our political allies, whether it was reasonable to expect that we'd be able to move through those. So there was all of these conversations. Ultimately, we did incredible mobilization and organizing. We had 30,000 people probably in the streets on May 12th. We got virtually no press coverage whatsoever. The most impressive organizing that I've been a part of with this coalition coming together in New York City, we got diddly squat in terms of being able to move a national narrative, right? Occupy was a lot of spinning off of that. And a few magical things happened, right? Like people getting arrested, right? There were some things that happened that no one could control, but managed to spark a real movement energy building, right? And so then self-organization took place, and self-organization really took off. And we've got to be able to help spark that without knowing that we can control it. Right? So this car wash the other day in Soho was announced that it was going to be sold. We got together the whole campaign, like, how are we going to control this messaging? Oh my God, it's going to scare car wash workers across the city into thinking, this is what happens if you organize, your car wash gets sold. And we were like, lots of machinations about how we're going to control the messaging. You know what? The press showed up at the protest, and people were off message within like 2 minutes, and they were like, this is what the boss is doing to try to shut down our organizing. And all of us who were into discipline and were freaking out. I was like, this is not the messaging we agreed on. This is not, you know what? Like, what the excuse my language. Like, at some level, we've got to be able to stir stuff up and know that it's not going to be all in our control. And car wash workers across the city are whether the boss was selling that car wash because it was more profitable to sell it for developers in Soho or because he's trying to shut down organizing, who cares? It's an indication that we've got to have bigger, badder, and more radical and militant fights if we're going to be able to beat people like... Woo-hoo! And so I feel like unions, we need robust community organizations with real funding to be able to sustain fights. We need unions willing to invest in and throw down with workers who are doing uncontrollable stuff, right? And we've got to be able to just, you know, follow those moments and combine the advantages of discipline, because we do want to be disciplined, we do want to be strategic, we do want to avoid being shut down by secondary boycott rules. Like, all of those things, RICO still exists. Like, we've got to be strategic. On the other hand, we've got to grapple with and be willing to throw down in a way that we can't fully control.
Amen. I don't have anything else to say about Occupy. Let me give you another national example, though. So in the age of Obama, if you compare movements, so think about the labor movement or think about the racial justice movement, and think about what advances those movements have made versus the gay rights movement and the immigrant rights movement, I think you get a snapshot of which movements were willing to take risks and which movements were pretty silent, especially when it came to the administration. The LGBT rights movement, immigrant rights movement, were pretty much fearless in the first term of the administration, challenging the president, being willing to get arrested at the White House. What labor leaders got arrested around EFCA at the White House, right? So there's a difference in terms of risk-taking and strategizing and being willing to go outside the box that I think we can learn from in the last 4 years. Secondly, I think we saw last year the rediscovery of the strike weapon. Workers actually still have power, believe it or not.
We always have.
We could shut down all the warehouses that supply Walmart and big box stores. There's actually power there. We saw that in Illinois and California. We saw what happened here in terms of car wash workers and fast food workers. We're rediscovering that even though we haven't used it in 30 years, it's still possible to use it and put pressure on employers. We have other examples of political victories at the state and local level. I think the most important ideological victory we've had in the last 30 years is the term living wage. And we've won all these victories around the living wage movement. Now we have to expand on these, but we actually have to claim that as a victory. At the same time that I think we have to be much more explicit about targeting the right the way they've targeted us. There's a reason why the right has gone after public sector unions. They know that's where the heart of the labor movement is in terms of funding and in terms of membership. We have to get smarter about which parts of the right do we target to destroy ideologically and organizationally so that we can advance further our movement.
There's businesses that really do cut corners, that engage in widespread wage theft, that really illegally misclassify regular employees and treat them as independent contractors so they don't have to pay Social Security taxes, so they don't pay health insurance, workers' compensation, unemployment insurance. You know, the phenomenon of wage theft has grown, misclassification has grown, and I wanted to ask Krisha and Angelo to discuss what can the government do, what should the government do?
Raising the minimum wage, right? You create more job growth in terms of people being able to put more money into the economy. You're going to be doing things like putting less pressure on the social welfare system because people aren't going to need the same type of services. We need to basically come back and understand that you may have low-wage workers, people being exploited, but the system is still basically subsidizing business because when you provide welfare, other social services, right now we talk about those things as things that we're giving to these poor people. No, these are things that we're doing to subsidize business so that they don't have to pay these people hardly anything. And we need to start developing those kinds of arguments and challenging the dominant logic that we have to, that we're constantly being hit with and too often basically accept. To me, what I loved about the Occupy Wall Street movement is that it basically began to challenge those things in a way that I think it got people a lot nervous. How do you sustain those kinds of challenges? That's another, back to, you know, thinking of people like the need to reread Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward's work around welfare organizing, around this issue of human serve and the kind of electoral organizing, which deals with the issue of really organizing folks to a level where they'll do things where who the hell knows where the hell it's going to wind up, how they're going to be overloading the system and challenging that logic. And I think we need to get to that point somehow.
The first thing the government has to do is that it just cannot focus on workers that complain. I think that in part is tied to union density. As union density goes down, the structures where workers can safely raise issues is starting to, you know, greatly erode. It's no surprise to me that the number one complaint filed at the EEOC is not discrimination, but retaliation. We can't rely just on workers who complain. We have to look at where are the industries where we think illegal behavior is happening and target those industries. We have to be more strategic in the way that we enforce. The other thing that government has to do is come out of its "We're the government, we do our own thing, we'll tell you later on in the case what's happened." We have to be part of the partnerships that are existing. And that's a very hard thing, I think, for government to contemplate, being part of a partnership and not being separate and apart from the low-wage worker organizing or the union organizing movements, but be strategic with the folks on the field. Better for those movements, it's better for government. That is one of the things that the Labor Department is doing, is it's trying to do directed investigations It's getting data. It's a data-driven system. Where do we think the violations are? And we're not going to wait for complaints. We're going to go in there and we're going to look at those industries. We do it locally, not necessarily just nationally. We can do what we can to try to be creative with what we have, but I really think that we need new tools. And I also think that probably the chances of getting new tools are far more on the local and the state level, and that's where we need to create our little experiments as this country's supposed to be, and then go from there.
So you're a Maoist, let a thousand flowers bloom.
Nice. So just to follow up on that, there's a great experiment in this question that we've seen in San Francisco the last 15, 20 years. So from roughly 1996 to 2008, San Francisco experimented with all kinds of regulations of the low-wage labor market. From paid sick days, which for some reason the Speaker of the City Council here can't bring to the floor, to a citywide minimum wage, to essentially the local version of healthcare reform in 2006, mandating that every employer offer health insurance to residents of the city or pay into a fund. And we have the evidence from economists that shows that raising the minimum wage to $11 an hour in San Francisco citywide did not result in job loss. Actually, it resulted in employment gains. More jobs were created in San Francisco than lost. Establishing the New York City Mayor's Office of Labor Standards, change the city's home rule authority. Those are really, they're not sexy, but they're really important. Really important. And those two things alone could radically change the New York City low-wage economy.
So we've for a long time been conservative in our policy asks. New York City's position for the last 13 years has been the city is not allowed to protect low-wage workers. Right? Enough with that.
Right.
I mean, we have a mayoral election where we obviously have an opening to demand that our candidates stand up for having a city that's responsible for and responsive to low-wage workers and working families. Right? We should not be so timid in our demand.
You've been listening to excerpts from Workers Rising, Low-Wage Worker Organizing, a recent conference by the Center for Popular Democracy and United New York.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.